Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that you can go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, we have our interesting customers pop in to rent something. We talk about the exciting things that they have going on in their lives, and we're always keen to hear what films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop. Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV? Good morning. Welcome to the video store. Thank you for wandering in to our lovely video store here. It's just me behind the counter. My name is Russell. I am the owner of The Bioscope, which is an independent cinema here in Johannesburg. And that's what keeps me busy when I'm not behind the counter here. Today on the show, we have ourselves another guest episode. We love these. We love showing you guys how the film is made, how the sausage is made, so to speak. And today we've got two members of the crew behind the film Lucky Fish. So we have Luke Roux, who is the producer, and Maureen Reddy, who is both the writer and the star of the film Lucky Fish, which is a very exciting, very fun comedy that has had the privilege of opening the Durban International Film Festival now this month and is now in cinemas. And the Bioscope will be screening it, which is very exciting and fun. And we look forward to bringing some comedy and bringing some laughs, especially ones that are authentically South African. And all right, let's waste no more time. Let's get into it. This is Luke and Maureen popping in to rent something. How's it, guys?
Are we rolling?
We're rolling.
Oh, cool, cool.
Ching-a-ling-a-ling. Hi. We are in a video store.
What a nice video store.
Thanks. Well, welcome, guys. How are you doing?
Great. I'm having a good day. Thanks for having us.
Is it a good day?
Yeah. I mean, tomorrow we have a pretty big thing happening and there's been a lot of activity.
What's happening tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're flying down to Durbs.
Okay.
And we are having the premiere of our film, Lucky Fish, which is opening the Durban International Film Festival.
Okay, you guys are the opening night film.
That's it.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And then we've got another sort of independent premiere that we're doing more for like the public on Friday.
Where's that going to be?
That's at the exact same cinema.
In Durban?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the 17th is for Dalanis, the diff industry people. And the politicians and whatnot. And then the 18th is for the plebs.
We've done that.
Well, that's bad, I should say.
No, you've recorded it now.
It's fine. I've gone to diff once. Daryl, the guy I started the Bioscope with.
I was going to ask.
He did a bit more film festival traveling and trips and things, and I was more the housewife that looked after the Bioscope when he was away, and I enjoyed it. Have you guys done diff before?
I've done it quite a few times.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember being diff runs a couple programs. They're in collaboration with Berlinale. They have the talent campus. So there's the Berlin talent campus, then there's one in Sarajevo and one in other places and Durban, and I was a member of the talent campus in 2012.
Okay, that like helps incubate and create films.
Well, it's a training program, and you can apply as an actor or a producer, director, writer, musician, critic. It's really very diverse and wide.
Okay.
And I remember on that, I mean, it was amazing. Like, quite a few of the members who were part of that cohort have gone on to have illustrious careers, and they had Tom Tikwa was the director who flew out, the guy who did Run Lola Run and Cloud Atlas, and an amazing director. He came in for that and was kind of the mentor to cohort, and it was really great to see him and meet him. But the project I had, you have to apply with the project, and the project I applied with is the one we literally just finished shooting a week ago. So
really?
It's taken a while, but we finally got there.
I think it's amazing just the timeline, and we often talk about that in the video stores. Like, when did this shoot? When did you do this? When did you do that? Because I think people forget that unlike a song that can be sort of banged out in the morning with the right recording equipment and the right lightning in the bottle,
yeah,
film takes an army and takes many, many years of your life.
I mean, I thought Lucky Fish took a while because we started writing in 2017, but I was reminded as Luke and Josh went into production for Breed van Jaar just recently that that thing was like started in 2012.
Yeah, it started a long time ago. These things, I mean, it's you're not working on it constantly. You're like, you know, tinkering every now and then. And then when there's an opportunity that arises, an AFP or RFP from a broadcaster, hey, we're looking for this type of thing.
What does that stand for?
Request for proposal. So
okay,
if, say, you know,
like a brief.
Yeah, a brief comes out. Then you look on your shelf and be like, okay, what have I been working on?
That certainly helps because whenever one is dealing with sponsorships or any kind of money of other people, whenever it feels like it's more their idea, they're often a little more generous. As opposed to you going, hi, I want to make this movie, and them going like, I don't know.
Well, it always starts with that, though.
It's the, you know, you say on your shelf or whatever, but like, remember that thing that we said when we were in college? I have various words. What's the nine words?
My brother studied in the States.
Oh, there.
At USC. Josh. And he came back with this book by a guy named Dov S.S. Siemens, who it was kind of like a how to make a movie. It wasn't great, but there was one key piece of information I took out of it, which is that any producer must know nine words and be able to say them. I have multiple projects in various stages of development. You just have to have things on the go all the
constantly
time.
Constantly in different.
You don't know when, which stick in the fire is going to ignite, you know?
Yeah. So, Luke, you're the producer.
That's it. That's me.
Okay. And then your brother,
Josh.
Josh is the director.
Yes.
Okay. And we want to talk about Lucky Fish primarily here. This is the movie that's opening at DIFF. This is the movie that's going to be in cinemas, including the Bioscope.
On the 25th of July.
From the 25th of July. It also got selected. The Bioscope every year hosts a selection from DIFF. And Lucky Fish is a part of that.
Oh, cool.
We've got a few touch points, one of which is in the soundtrack.
That's right. Okay. It's such a circuitous way of figuring it out, but Russell is part of the band Short Straw.
No.
Yes. Yeah. And we feature...
Oh, my goodness.
We feature the amazing song Bikini Weather in Lucky Fish.
Yeah. And so that was very cool to come along, and it was just this... I knew you, and I also want to talk about our first meeting.
You know that you and I then met in 2013 without knowing, because Short Straw was the soundtrack for Shotgun Garfunkel, which was the fastest film ever made.
Yes,
in 2013, and I think you guys actually performed on stage in one of the scenes.
Did we?
It was in a. Oh, I remember scene, yeah.
I don't know whether we were in the movie. I just know that the soundtrack was a part of that.
Yeah,
because there were Brian many, and Asher are good
Brian
friends.
Brian Asher, exactly.
And they were just like, we just need as many songs as possible.
Yeah, and you guys just, like, everybody just pulled together within, like, 10 days.
Shotgun Garfunkel was a very cool movie, and it was a fun exercise done by guys who've actually been on the video store, Brian and Asher.
They're very talented.
Oh, team best, right?
Team best. We had them on the show to talk mostly about wine because they are the guys who started Duus Wine.
Yeah.
So speaking of other great ideas, these guys had an idea, which was how quickly can we make a fully fledged feature film to set a record?
It's so weird because that I know that they were the focus of the podcast, but actually it was Johnny Barbazzano, Tiffany Barbazzano, and we got together and we were like, the Indians did it in 11 days and 23 hours. What can we do? And we were stressed. We were like, cool,
so
we're going to do it.
It was your idea.
It was more like Johnny and Tiffany. We were in a point in our careers where it felt like there was a lull. Johnny was starting something in about like 3 weeks. Tiffany had just had her baby and she was itching to get back into acting. And I had a writing house that was it was in a hiatus. And the three of us were at Johnny's house and we were like having a couple of drinks or whatever. And I don't know how they knew Asher and Brian, but they did. And as soon as the tequila was flowing over, it, this thing happened, and then Brian and Asher very quickly, I think right then and there, we called them, and I didn't even know who they were, and all of a sudden, like,
you were making this
3 days later, we're all around a table.
It's such a lovely movie, and it's a shame that I don't think it's that readily available. Where one can't watch it anywhere, hey?
Well,
I think it was sold to the net to the multi-choice library, the Africa library.
Yeah, but I can't really see it anywhere.
Stuck somewhere.
We'll figure it out.
Shotgun Garfunkel. We must get it back.
Anyway, but let's get back to
No, but it's just cool because I've been doing a lot of reflection. The Bioscope turned 15 now this last month.
Woohoo!
And
congrats.
The moment you just look back on the thousands of films we've screened, one of which was Shotgun Garfunkel.
Well, we needed you guys, because in order to break the record, you had to get it to a paying audience. So I don't know, like you said, you said it at like 20 Rand or whatever.
I think we made it super cheap.
Super cheap. But the way it ends, the clock stops when the movie starts in front of a paying audience. And you could bring a person from Guinness to follow you for the 10 days or whatever, but you could pay a large amount. Or you have to document it yourself. And so we did it, and we had a little clock in the corner.
Oh, that's right.
And we stopped it as the movie started.
How long? Okay, just to wrap up Shotgun Garfunkel.
Yeah,
it is worth a mention. How many days did you do it in?
It was 10 days, 10 and a half hours. And we only held it for a year. But I think I believe we made a good movie, because the Namibians broke it a year later in like 9 days. But the movie was like, you know.
Interesting. Okay. Tell me about Lucky Fish. Where did this germinate? Where did this start?
Hey, it started with Multi-Choice, actually. Craig Gardner is one of the co-writers of Lucky Fish, and he was commissioned to do a pilot for Multi-Choice.
I think it's significant to say that Craig Gardner created Suburban Bliss.
That's important to mention.
Yeah, a very, very funny director and writer. And he Multi-Choice paid for this pilot for something called Miss Pilchards at the time. It was very different.
Was it originally going to be a TV show?
Yeah, it was a TV show. So they did a pilot
documentary,
episode.
Like in the vein of The Office.
Yeah, okay, cool.
And then that didn't go, but there was a clause in the contract that said, you know, the producer has the right to buy back the rights. And so then, 7, 8 years ago, Marin and Craig started working together, and Marin had the idea of like, I really like this Miss Pilchards thing, but it would be great for this for an Indian audience.
The important thing was the way it was framed was it was two characters, a husband and wife, who were doing a beauty pageant and just happened to car crash with a guy who owned a Pilchards company.
Okay.
And he was not the focus of the thing. He just kind of came on board and is very much in the background in that version, where he's like putting pressure on them because he's sponsoring it now, because they can't pay his
insurance.
It was very different, and it was a mockumentary, and it followed something completely different.
Sure.
When Craig gave it to me, I told him he didn't realize how meaningful tinfish is to an Indian community.
Okay.
Tinfish sandwiches on a beach is something that every Indian person goes through, you know, and you joke about it, like aunties with biryani pots and stuff coming to the beach, which is ludicrous, but it happens. But tinfish sandwiches tinfish curry is incredibly significant to an Indian market. So I was like, we're going to pivot the whole thing now.
Okay. So what is this movie about? Because I think it's worth mentioning, and I will own the fact that I haven't had a chance to watch it. There was one point, as we said, when Short Straw was going to be on the soundtrack, and I think we'd agreed on everything. I think we'd maybe even sent through the paperwork, and then I was like, what's the movie about?
It's not pornography,
is it? And I sort of said something like, what's the scene? Like, I think that should be some due diligence.
Yes.
I knew you, Luke, so I trusted you, and I had faith that the movie was great. But there was a part of me that was like, wait, what's this about? And you were like, it's going to be in a scene with the sardine run.
That's right, okay. There's a great scene in the film. But set the tone.
We call it the back of the box here at the Video Store, what would be... what you would read or see on the back.
I think the technical term for that is the blurb.
The blurb. But yeah, we've got our name for it.
Right, so the blurb
the back of the box.
The blurb of Lucky Fish follows Sanjay Pillay, who's a Tinfish Pilchards company owner in Durban, Phoenix. His company's not doing very well. It's a family-run business. And
it's competing against Lucky Star and Glenn Ricks and stuff. He's like this tiny. Yeah.
Okay. When we meet him, he's like paying his debts in cases of his tin fish. Yeah. Nobody wants to take his debt. He's in debt to loan sharks up to his neck. Okay. And so he gets this idea to sponsor a beauty pageant to try and, you know, raise awareness about his Pelé's Pilchards tin fish and hopefully get some sponsors and some money coming in for his business. And he ropes his sister in to do it, to help him with it, Samantha. She's not too keen because she has a 10-year-old daughter and she doesn't like the idea of objectifying women in a beauty pageant. But when she sees her 10-year-old daughter looking with kind of, you know, desire and angst at the TV screen of another beauty pageant, she says, yes, I'll go ahead and do it because I want to prove to my daughter that every woman is beautiful. And I'll only do it if it's an all-inclusive beauty pageant.
So they have the idea to put on a beauty pageant as a way to help save money.
It's a PR exercise.
He wants to do the pageant because he believes that there is advertising that he will get out of this and sponsors will come on board and his company will be saved. She wants to do it because she believes that the way that beauty is presented to the world is wrong and it's affecting her daughter, and she feels it's an opportunity to prove to her daughter that every woman is beautiful in their own way.
Yeah.
But he does not hear, as long as it's open to everyone. He's just like, yes, you're on board now. I can move on with my life. Everything's going to work out.
Then he pitches up to judge the first round of contestants that his sister has organized. And, you know, this is not your typical beauty pageant fair. One is in a wheelchair. Another has bandages wrapped around her face. A third one is heavily pregnant. Another one is really quite large. And, you know, these are all women from the community who Samantha thinks is beautiful. And and he's like, what are you doing? You're going to ruin my company. This is bad PR. Tries to get out of it. But then the press catch wind of it. They love the story. Okay. And he can't. He has to double down. He can't back out.
It's almost got like full Monty energy.
Yes, I'd say that's like, a good...
You know, you got the old men doing the calendar shoot or the strip show.
Yes,
it's the
exactly.
Same energy.
Yeah, yeah.
Maren, you're acting.
I was...
He's the lead actor.
I was pushed into it, yes.
Okay, so you were originally set to be the writer of it, eh?
I was going
to
write and produce with Luke. That's all I was...
Maren is an amazing actor. In fact, where we met was... in acting college at AFTA, just up the road here.
Okay.
And we did a sitcom called City Sessler back in the day, maybe it's 20 years ago now. And that was led to 5 seasons and was a big success. But we've since kind of stepped away from acting a little bit more.
2019 was the last acting gig I did. I was in Trackers.
Yes.
And after that experience, I was like, with Luke, I was like, there's so much more control on the other side. I feel more comfortable there, and I hate the limelight, and it's just like, I hate all of that stuff. It's better to be in my little writing hole. Luke believes in the stuff that I write. I can do that. He'll produce it, and that will be our relationship, you know?
Yeah.
But then when we started getting some traction around Lucky Fish and the money started coming together, I was like, bro, there's nobody else who can do this.
You.
It has
to
be you.
But I didn't write it for me. I wrote it for another actor. And I wrote the words because I knew what he was capable of. So it's a thicker Indian accent. He's more part of the community. Like, all done, right? And then Luke and I kind of had a weird conversation with Amazon Prime, I feel. And Luke got off the call and he was like, dude, they're kind of insinuating something here. If you don't, like, do it. And so we had a conversation about it. And I was like, fine, I'll do it. But then what it took was... complete rewrite, like,
okay,
what the other actor could do, I could absolutely not pull off, you know, with those words in my mouth wouldn't work.
Maren is by his own admission, like, not very
the least Indian.
Sure, no, but listen, okay, I love this. It's almost reminding me a little bit of Brett Goldstein, who comes into all his projects as a writer and then always ends up sort of having to act it. You know, he wasn't meant to be. What's that? What
in
is
it? Fleabag? Is it
no, like the character, the grumpy main guy in Ted Lasso.
Oh, okay.
Roy Kent. Mm. He wasn't meant to be Roy Kent.
Okay, yes.
Until eventually it was like, okay, only one guy can do this, and it's him, because he's kind of, you know, been at
very
the helm.
Very specific, yeah.
How Durban are you, Maren?
Not at all. I'm born and bred in Joburg. I mean, up until we shot there... The most I've maybe went to Durban like 5 or 6 times in my life, and I spent like 2 or 3 days there. Like, this was the longest stretch.
You have a lot of extended family that
No, sure, but just your, I suppose.
But I mean, I'm not even connected to the extended family. Like,
I mean, that was a big concern. We were worried about that. But you know, the rest of the cast really fill out that Durban space for us. Mayuri Naidu and Jack Devnarain and Kesrin Pillay and Jailoshni Naidu is fantastic and has a huge following in Durban.
Yeah, it must be worth mentioning that Durban needs some love.
Yes.
And it needs some spotlight. It needs
some
attention.
Not just Durban, though. It's Phoenix, specifically. Yeah. We shot in Phoenix. Every time I told somebody, hey, we're going to shoot a movie in Phoenix, they all gave me that eye roll. Are you really sure? Yeah, and I was worried about it. I mean, we had enough budget for security, but the community of Phoenix really embraced us.
Well, wasn't that the whole point of why Phoenix got some press recently? It was the fact that they stood up for themselves.
Am I getting that right? I'm not familiar.
That was during the riots.
Exactly. Yeah. So during the riots, Phoenix
was
one of those towns that like...
held a line. Yeah.
Yeah. They the community came out with guns.
That old lady, there's a picture of an old lady with a shotgun and the shotgun shells.
The ammo
and I'm not sure, but I think she's actually wearing a sari. It is the most incredible picture.
That's my only knowledge of Phoenix was that. Well, I never really had much else.
It is a beautiful community. Everybody kind of, when you think of Durban and Indian, you kind of automatically go to Chatsworth, and that's had quite a bit of screen time with the Kanasamy films.
Yeah.
But we just fell in love with it. It was a beautiful neighborhood. We went on this location scout, and we were looking for a park, and we stopped off at a bunch of different parks, and we found this one park, and there was, the police officers. It was on a Friday, I think, and so they gather their troops together and have a briefing, and they were doing that, and we were just looking through the park, and this guy comes up to us and starts chatting to us. Is he a captain or is he a lieutenant?
I think he was a captain. Yeah.
And we tell him we're making a movie and we're looking for locations.
We can't put on the accent.
I'm not going to do that. But he says, if you're looking for locations, you can come shoot at my house. I got a great house.
This is an Indian police captain.
That's right. Okay. Captain Moodley, I think his name was. And so we're like, cool, yeah, let's go check your house out. So the next day we pitch up at his house. Yeah. It is like a mansion, like a three-story mansion, and on the top of a little hill in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Let me not say anything bad about it, but it was a perfect location, and he was so happy and welcoming to have us there. We ended up shooting, the first day of shoot was in his house, and we shot the whole day. So yeah, we had a lot of those experiences. We lost some of our locations, and the community kind of rallied around us and helped us find something.
Yeah.
So we had a great time, no crime, it was perfectly safe, and we were very welcomed.
Okay. Is some of the perception the fact that there is some crime in that neighborhood?
Yeah, and also it's like... I don't know how to put it. It's like Phoenix is kind of the metaphor for the movie in a weird way. It's like this thing that doesn't get paid attention to. Like Luke said, you know, it's Chatsworth. Like Chatsworth and Phoenix, I believe, because I'm not that Indian, are the two large Indian communities, or at least where the, when the Group Areas Act or whatever, like where the Indian people were pushed to.
Yeah.
But Chatsworth seems to get a lot of love in terms of movies and, you know, when you speak about Durban or whatever, and Phoenix feels like it's neglected. And when I was writing the movie, even Craig was like, no, but dude, like the Kandaswamy is like, you know, chats with him. I'm like, no, really, let's focus a little bit more on this thing.
You guys have
sort of
dug a little deeper and gone into sort of, more detail, which is great.
I mean, we feature other neighborhoods in the film, Durban North, and the Promenade is featured heavily.
Yeah. But Durban's had some tough times, eh?
It has, yes.
I mean, they were the epicenter of those riots, which of course spread across the country.
And then the floods.
Then those floods, man. When you see some of those those hills that just
pummeled.
Imagine just having a garden, like knowing on your deed that you have a certain amount of sort of square meterage, and then like half of it just falls away. Like you just lose your land.
Yeah.
It's the wildest thing.
And it's adversely affected the poorest communities because they sit their informal settlements close to the river because nobody's living there.
And nobody tells
the river,
them anything about a flood line.
Exactly. Yeah. Then the river raises and they just get their lives erased, you know.
But it's lovely. And I that's what I do appreciate. And I think you know this because you've been in many of these circles, but you hear the speeches where they say, we've got to tell our stories. And I mean, it's important that we tell our stories. Mm. And you just like, if you were to play a drinking game at like a festival opening and you drink every time some some politician says that, you would be smashed.
Russell, yeah. It's amazing what you're doing to me. I was just saying to Luke outside, like, he was like, are you excited? And I'm like, I'm not, man. I'm like, it feels like so much pressure to put these premieres together and, you know, coordinate all of it. But the way you're speaking now is actually like making me quite excited about tomorrow and Friday. Yeah, like,
well, you literally are doing
it. We're telling our story. You know, it's a completely local film made by local creatives who are all good friends with each other. We received funding from those communities, from the KZN Film Commission. We got some money from them. We got some money from CIRL, the Presidential Economic Stimulus Program.
Good old CIRL.
Got some money from the NFEF.
Okay.
And the DTIC, when it was still functioning, we did get some money from them. And this is literally telling our story. And, you know, we were heavily inspired by the Kandasamis. I remember watching that film with my wife. And I'm not the target market, but I was like, man, this is so much fun. It's just so joyful and colorful and new, and I hadn't experienced it before, and I developed an appetite for that, those type of stories. I think Jayanne did a great job with that.
Yeah, man. And she helped. Listen, it's important that she helped us. That's what I'm saying. Like, everybody rallied. Like, we going to, oh, man, it was such a weird year last year. I was on the verge of leaving for LA to do a residency, but, you know, we had an 11 or 12 week pre-prod period. And so for the last 5 weeks, I would have been in LA. So right at the beginning of it, the first person I got a hold of was Jayanne, and she shared her crew list with me immediately. She spent an hour and a half on the phone with me. These are the places you need to focus on. She also was like, dude, Phoenix, wow, I'm a little bit worried. But the amount of information that she gave
us. Was she the producer of those films?
She was the producer of Kandasamis, yeah.
Well, the director as well and the writer. And it's really her creative vision for those films.
How many did they make in the end?
I think they're on number four now.
So hey, man.
Two in theatrical release.
It's a winning ticket.
Well, they it was more than a winning ticket. It was a huge box office hit. The first one was 14, 16 million, somewhere around there. The second one was 18 million. Then she sold the rights to Netflix, and they've done two or three there now.
I also think back a little earlier to a film like Material, which really got South Africa's attention. Yeah, you know, if done right, if smart, if slick, if endearing,
and
heartwarming.
You know, and during that same period, a very gritty film, which for me was the redheaded stepchild to Spud, because the producers had the rights that were running out, that the rights were coming to an end, and Anand Singh was going to pick them up. But they had the rights to this book called 31 Million Reasons, and it was about the SBV heist that happened in 97-98 in Durban. And so Material comes out, and then this movie comes out. But the interesting thing about Indian content is you wait 4 or 5 years and then a new piece of Indian content comes out. Like, it's a starved market, you know?
Yeah,
and they've kind of fallen through the cracks. I mean, you get every now and then you get a big marquee thing like the Kandasamis and hopefully Lucky Fish, but that audience still wants to be entertained. So you've got like the Broken Promises franchise. I don't know if you've heard of that.
No,
which is on number four. It's movies like homegrown Durban-based Indian movies that with complete unknown actors, like just Durban people for their Durban audience. The first three they distributed themselves basically through DVDs, and then the fourth one, they had a big push in it, a theatrical release. And it's just they're telling their own stories, and they're just getting it done.
But they are like nestled in the middle, like the Kings of Mulberry Street, the Kings of Mulberry Street 2, 3 days to go. Bianca's movie, The Honeymoon. So they're all, but they're like these big splashes happen like once every 5 or 6 years, you know, and then there are all these little ones like sort of nestled in the middle.
Yeah, I also think it's worth mentioning, I remember it blew my mind, is that we're not just talking about a significant Indian market. This is the largest diaspora of Indian people outside of India that live in KZN and in Durban surrounds. So it is a massive market.
Yeah, and
of course it's also spread across the country, and I just think that there's actually very close to us here is the Fordsburg, Mayfair kind of part of the world, also more green side. You can see these little pockets of communities, which is amazing.
And the community is, to a degree, homogenous. I mean, the Bollywood content that people consume is, you know, interesting because it has to appeal to an audience that really does not speak the same language. So a lot of it is dance, and it's very verbose. Our South African Indian audience are like very family orientated, and So that is automatically, from a producer's point of view, you're like, great, this is...
And humor is such a big part of South African storytelling as well.
Comedy and family-oriented. So like, these are people who come out. Like, the success of the Kanasami films, you know, that was not just because it was, you know... It was because there were repeat viewings.
Sure.
And it was because the corporate culture, corporates came and said, okay, we're going to buy cinemas and we're going to sell these tickets ourselves to employees. And
that's cool.
And the Indian community gathered around this film to really lift it up. And we're hoping for the same. Well, we're seeing that already.
How lovely is it that she, did you say Jo-Ann?
Jo-Ann.
That she was so willing to see you thrive.
Oh, man. She was so
helpful.
I mean,
that says so much about her as well.
She came to set... we had lunch together. We've been on calls almost once a week for the last like maybe 6-7 weeks.
Bianca Isaacs, who did Honeymoon and 3 Days to Go, she's become a good friend, and she also totally helped us.
And they don't have any like literal skin in the game. They literally just want to see this movie work.
Yeah, and they want to help you. The film community in Durban is quite small, so you know, they want to make sure that they steer you towards the people who are going to help you the best and that they protect you and help, you know, make sure that you're not going to get screwed over or, you know, that you really take the correct precautions as best as you can.
Yeah. Lovely, man. Luke, you and I first met in the airport.
That's right.
In Cannes.
On the way back from Cannes.
That was the first time we ever met.
Yes.
You were doing something kind of similar in the sense that you were a part of some form of...
So I had
incubator.
I had produced a short film for the Johannesburg 48-hour film festival, right? So you know that one.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the first time it happened in Joburg, and Marin was involved. Were you involved?
No,
I don't remember. No.
You wanted in 2012?
Yes.
I wanted in 2013.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So
because this was 2011, it's the only time we've ever gone to Cannes was in 2011.
Yes. And so our short film,
Valentine.
That's right. Movie. It was a great film. I really enjoyed that. And we won everything that year, but that's because it was the first time, and our film was like clearly head and shoulders above everyone else. And then so it got selected to represent at the Filmapalooza in Miami somewhere. The top 10 short films then get a chance to screen at the Cannes Short Film Corner. And so my film was screening in Cannes, and I managed to wangle the Alliance Française to pay for my ticket. It was actually, I should not have gone, I realize in retrospect.
Yeah.
You know,
why? Because you're the short corner is actually what?
No. The reason was good to go, but Russell, you were there.
Sure.
It is like 65,000 of the world's top film creators.
It's overwhelming.
It's completely overwhelming.
Yeah,
and
I
was not prepared, and I didn't have the support for it. I was living in Mandaloo, Lunapool, which is a half-hour train ride into Cannes.
We by sheer luck got a sort of floor in a, literally like we slept on the floor of a living room of someone who lived in Cannes. Thank goodness. Mm. It was a sort of friend of a friend.
But and I mean, I just remember the overall...
If we didn't have that hookup, we would have been taking trains in.
But. Bro, the feeling I got was just like, this is too much. I wasn't ready for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I went and met.
But now, just unpacked, in what way? Like, when you say unprepared by being overwhelmed, and unprepared because you didn't have material that you were going there to sell. Like,
I wasn't trying to sell anything. I was trying to make some connections. So I had set up some meetings and was trying to like work some stuff. Hey, I have the short film that's screening. And some people paid attention to that. But ultimately, like being on your own, like because I was there by myself and having no support and just this, it's like,
sure.
If you are a surfer and you're going into the biggest wave ever of your life,
you're probably not going to go into it.
Like, you're scared. Yeah. That's horrible,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, it's about, like, it's like standing at the foot of the mountain, knowing that, like, it'll take a lot to climb, and maybe you can just sort of hang around at base camp.
But
drink some hot chocolate.
I was so inspired by our conversation with you and Daryl.
Daryl, yeah.
Because you guys had met with Michel Gondry, and you were trying to do that.
Oh, whoa.
Making the film thing.
Yeah, so we thought we needed to go to Cannes. The Bioscope was about a year old at that point. I don't know why we sort of just, because the biggest part of it is the market.
Mm.
You know, obviously the world knows about the screenings and the competition, but the market,
underneath,
which is effectively literally under the main cinema,
the marche du film,
is really what ticks the whole sort of film industry over in many ways. And a lot of deals are done there. And we thought that's where we needed to go to, like, get films to screen at the Bioscope. And then it was worked out that the timing would be good because we were going to do this, well, we were aiming to do this Home Movie Factory, which is, it was a big project devised by Michel Gondry, which was traveling the world at the time. It was inspired by the movie Be Kind, Rewind, where he'd figured out this, like, big workshop filled with lots of sets and lots of ideas where someone could go in, person off the street, for free, and make a movie. But you're not making the world's greatest movie. You're just doing this for fun. It's the joy of movie making. And if we were to be in Cannes, the main guy from the Allianz, or IFAS, one of the French agencies, he was there. Let's try see whether we can set up a meeting to kind of get his blessing. And we were able to meet him.
You told me it was like a 5-minute meeting.
Yeah, in a sort of lobby in a hotel. And it was,
that's
it
a
was
claim
delightful.
To fame, man.
No, it was lovely. And there's a photo of the moment. It's hanging out in the lobby. I'll show it to you when we finish this visit. And it was a lovely thing to see. And you at one point, obviously being part of the film market gives you certain accreditation, and you can go some places where normal just people who live in the town can't. And there was one great moment where there was a big flurry of shouting and calling towards a man that was sort of just walking very briefly past us with the sunglasses and a hat. And you realize, like, that's Jude Law. Because everyone else is, like, calling his name. And you're like, oh, shit, that's Jude Law.
So we're around the corner.
That's Cannes.
I'm driving here, and a lot of memories because AFTA's right up there. But the Refinery is a loft apartment. And Ryan Poole and Morgan Dingle used to live there. And Ryan came back with a story because he went to Cannes thinking he was a big shot. And something ridiculous, like Edward Norton, he was like in a bar, and Edward Norton was there having a very intense conversation with somebody else. And he tried to butt in, and Edward Norton chewed him out.
Yeah.
To the point where, and Ryan was a big guy, and he just crumbled and into the corner, and he was like, that was his Cannes story.
Yeah.
It was a good Cannes because I went to the premiere of The Beaver by, oh man, who's it?
Oh, is that Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster?
Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster, that's right. And it was Terrence Malick's
Tree of Life was
there. Tree of Life was amazing.
So we watched Tree of Life. We were able to book, like, the press ticket so you could watch it early.
Yeah, I only figured that out on the day as well. You get a certain amount of points and they reset every 12 hours so you can try and book tickets. But even if you booked a ticket, like, you're going to spend an hour in the queue.
But you're watching these movies, like, we watched Melancholia at about 8:30 in the morning.
Wow.
And people were getting so excited. More press were wanting to take spots. And they, of course, want a press person over just a market film person, because press is more important than someone who's going to potentially buy it, funny enough, because you get more press, I guess. And so we got bumped out of our screening, and then they said, no, we've just added another screen. So we were running across the sort of, like, Cannes.
It's crazy. It's madness.
Square.
Yeah.
At 8:30, and I just said to Daryl, we laughed, we were like, nowhere else in the world will you be running at 8:30 in the morning for art house cinema. Like, that just won't happen anywhere else. Tree of Life, Melancholia, it was a nice year.
Saw a film that I should not have seen, actually. It's really scarred me. It stayed with me forever.
Which one?
It's called Michael. And, oh, man, I was waiting in the queue for it. And then they said, okay, the tickets are sold out, but don't worry, there's another screening. So I was like, okay, great. So then I waited for another hour for that screening. And it's about, this is getting really dark, but it's about a pedophile who has kidnapped this kid, and it's their relationship. It's just so disturbing.
No, there's dark stuff out there, and, like, some of the stuff's quite challenging. Okay, so let's maybe just touch a little on some things. We're a video store. Have you guys got anything that you've watched recently that you want to return here?
Mm-hmm. My kid went onto the IMDb top 100 films, and he's making his way through them. So I'm rewatching a lot of incredible films.
What a cool kid!
Yeah, he rates them. He's got Interstellar is used to be his favorite film.
How old is he?
He's 17, but he's been doing this since the age of like 14. Okay. We've been like making our way through films.
Oh, so what a cool dude!
Yeah, so Interstellar was, and then recently 3 weeks ago, because his mom's favorite film is The Godfather, so I watched it with the three of them. He's like, okay, this hedges Interstellar.
Okay.
Then last week we watched LA Confidential. Okay. Wow, I forgot how good that movie was.
Okay. That's due rewatch for me because I remember it being one of those, like, you got to watch it.
I was too young
for it at the time. Yeah. I was like, this is a bit boring.
So the things that I'm watching at the moment aren't contemporary. I'm watching, I'm just doing this with the kid because I want to support whatever it is going on in his head.
Did you see the New York Times 100 greatest films of the last, of the 21st
century?
Did you see the list?
No, but it goes from 2000 to now.
I
haven't checked it out.
Okay.
Number
one is Parasite.
Really?
Wow. So I'd be curious to know what you and your son think of that.
Well, I've got my opinions on Parasite, but he hasn't watched it yet.
Yeah, I know. Mm. Okay, so recently was LA Confidential.
Most recently, and well, they watched The Godfather, the third Godfather, two nights ago, and I was like, oh man, I can't put myself through that again. I watched the opening and I was like, okay, I'm out.
Yeah. My side is more on the TV side. Ooh. I've really been enjoying Stick, I must say, on Apple TV.
It is fun, hey?
Yeah, just joyful and...
It's quite a typical story, but it's got some nice sort of fresh new take on it. Do you know about it?
No.
Marin? Owen Wilson is a washed-up golf pro who sees like a phenom and bets everything he has on trying to take him professional.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Like a young kid who's like very Gen Z.
Very.
And they pick up a few other
Gen Z
characters.
So is that relationship about the intergenerational...
Absolutely. Mark Maron plays... like the old grumpy man,
who like is his old caddy, who's
total
like a
boomer.
Boomer, yeah.
Yeah, and to see the conflict between him and the Gen Zers is really fun.
It's because for me, the thing that was really great was Only Murders in the Building.
Yeah.
That generational.
That was fun as well, yeah. No, totally. It's got the same charm in that sense, but with a little bit of
Stick is fun. And the golf stuff is beautiful to watch as well.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of golf, but... Maybe. Okay. I've never swung a golf stick in my life.
Mark Maron as well was like, I know nothing about golf, but I'm in this golf show, which is interesting.
And then I guess, I always go back to, in my head, the classic. Like the best TV show I think in the world is Breaking Bad. Okay. But actually I would put the prequel to that of Better Call Saul as probably something I enjoyed more.
Okay.
I'm a kind of guy who's looking for stuff that's, not necessarily family friendly, but that stuff is not going to make me cringe, And I found Breaking Bad, there's violence in it and there's some dodgy stuff, but actually Better Call Saul is completely clean, 100% clean.
Oh, interesting.
No extreme violence. There's some people get killed or whatever.
It's all insinuated. Yes. And it's all,
But the cleverness of it is fascinating. And I think the fact that you start out with a main character where where he's going to end up. Like, his end journey.
Yeah.
But he doesn't look like that in the beginning. So it's so fascinating to speak. I've never seen that
like
before.
Like, what strips him away? What each little tiny digit, like just a slow, slow burn over six seasons into what we know he's going to become. You know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
We did sort of season one, episode one in the script writing at Wits.
Of Better Call Saul?
Breaking Bad.
Yes.
Which also,
although that is not a good example because that is a pure money grab. That thing is written to be like to get a pilot made. It's a very good script.
Sure.
But to start out with a guy in his underpants in the middle of the desert running away from criminals, it's like we try to make a TV pilot here, The rest of the episodes become much more
well that episode four, I mean, when the guy's trapped at the bottom
of his basement.
Of his basement.
Yeah.
That his was, first kill.
Mm,
wow. Power. What an episode.
Mm, lovely.
Yeah.
What is the rest of this week for you guys? You said you're gonna go to Durban.
Man, we're just cram packed full of premieres. So tomorrow night is our opening night of Diff premiere, which is for the Lonnies, and then on the 18th we have another.
Well, you
premiere.
Say Lonnies, but it's like for me, I feel like that's the one where I'm like, oh boy, it's all the like politicians and delegates. It's like very for me a little bit up its own butt.
Sure, but kind of sometimes necessary, I guess.
Yeah, and. I mean, you've got the Minister of Arts and Culture will be talking there, the guy who's ever running the UKZN who runs Diff.
Do me a favor, play the drinking game.
Oh, right.
And
with
please,
tell our stories. Okay.
Please tell me how drunk you get.
Wait. What's the drinking game?
No. Every time somebody says we want to tell our
it's
stories,
important that
we
tell our
drink.
Stories.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Like, let's play that game.
Well, I mean, I think that's why they chose this Lucky Fish, because it is such a
it's such a great example of it. That's what I'm saying. And we can celebrate.
It's set in Durban. We shot in Durban. KZN, funded it.
It's so weird though when people say, you know, we tell our stories. For me, as soon as people do that, they get a bit too deep, right? And they're like, it's the angst of telling our stories from the ground. This movie is a comedy, which has a really, really cool message at the end of it that finds itself. It doesn't sit on its soapbox. It doesn't tell you the thing that you're learning. Mm. And it's, for me, it's always better to wrap shit in comedy than it is in drama, because in drama, as soon as you're going to message whatever's coming out of Lucky Fish in a drama, you stand on your soapbox. And so when you say this is your story, it's like Luke and I, just all the way back to college, you tell a story set in a tiny, tiny place.
Yeah.
Like you said, the Full Monty, whatever. I was also inspired by The Castle, the Australian movie The Castle, and then The Dish, which was Sam Neill.
It's about the moon landing,
and it's just set in the small town.
Totally.
You do that, but it's at the end of it, it says this massive thing. And totally. So for me, it's not like, we're telling our stories. It's like, this is going to, it's like such a joy to watch this thing at the end of it. And you're like, oh my God, I was moved, you know? I didn't expect that to happen, you know?
Yeah, I think you guys have done it right, because that's where South African storytelling can sometimes go wrong, is that you got to keep it small, because our budgets are small, our abilities are smaller, we can't necessarily do these grander, but bigger also projects.
It's also in the writing, Russell. It's like, you know, how many times you watch a movie and I close my eyes and I cringe because the thing that you're supposed to be learning is being said in dialogue. Yeah. Or it's the thing, like, I hate you. No, you never say you hate the person.
The expression is show, don't
tell. It comes out.
It's a lovely filmmaking lesson that everyone should learn, is show, don't tell.
But it's easier said than done, because totally. your instinct in the moment, specifically as a writer, your instinct is to say it.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got to figure out how not to say it, but say it without saying it.
Yeah. So you guys have been chums forever, eh? You were at Varsity together.
Yeah, I just did a LinkedIn post about our 25-year friendship. That's my only social media outlet.
What bonded you guys? What was that moment where you were like, you can be my friend?
Luke, you tell the story, tell it.
Well, you know, Maren was an NSA kid, right? So National School of Arts just up the road. So he was like a golden boy from there. And I had studied, I'd done house plays at high school.
Yeah, where were you?
I was in Willow Ridge High School in Pretoria, kind of a no-name brand school. Our claim to fame is Roland Schumann.
I'll take it, bro.
Ours is Elon Musk.
Oh, wow. Wait, were you in Pretoria, boys?
No, I was at Bryanston. One of the many schools he went to struggled and got bullied and left.
Oh, really? Wow.
Were you one of the bullies?
No, this was long before my time.
Okay.
But no, it was one of those, like, that's actually quite a big name. Not under good.
Not necessarily one you want to publicize.
Okay, so in terms of South African famous athletes, that's one of them. Okay. Mm.
So Maren was, I kind of, almost failed my way through high school. Didn't really have any purpose or passion in my life.
Okay.
I'd done some acting, so I thought, actually I wanted to sail. My goal was to sail around the world. And my dad, who's a doctor, one of his patients was kidnapped by pirates and said, okay, you're not doing that, so figure something else out. So I was like, okay, well, acting. And then Dion Oppermann had his school opening, and he was so charismatic, and we had all seen him do his thing at Grahamstown Arts Festival, so I was like, okay, I'll give this a try. And then when I arrived there, I was on fire. I was like set on fire, the passion for acting and for
arrived where
At AFTER. Yeah.
Okay.
And
yeah.
So, like, Maren was stuck in his NSA bubble for about a year, or maybe seven months.
April, I remember. It was April of that year. And eventually, and immediately after whatever this moment is that you're about to say.
Okay. So then, you know, my dad's a doctor, and the school fees are expensive, and he's paying for my education here. And a lot of the other kids, it's a private tertiary education.
AFTER, outcomes based as well. So,
like, you know, it's expensive. Mm. And so people. A lot of people who are there are not really kind of interested in learning. They just want to have a good time. And one of the lecturers had walked out because people were making too much noise and weren't paying attention. And I was like, I had it. I was up to here. And I said, you people, my father is paying so much money for me to be here. You better pay attention. And apparently that caught Marin's attention.
You were sitting in the room at that time.
So I had the same feeling that Luke had, but we were the young ones, right? Because I think the average age in that first year was around 20, 23. Like,
okay.
Because there were people
who were fresh out of high school, so it was like 19.
People had done other degrees, people had like worked or whatever, you know. So we're straight out of high school.
You went sort of 19.
Yeah.
I was 17, you know. And, you know.
How are you that much younger?
I turned 18 in May of that year. So I was 17 in matric and then 18 in, you know.
It happens.
You just started early.
Yeah.
Your parents put you in school earlier.
I don't know. Something happened. Yo.
Something must have happened.
So when Luke said that, I could not believe that somebody vocalized it. I mean, these people were like 23-year-old bullies, dude. They were in the back. They were talking, blah, blah, blah. This lady had lost her shit, the lecturer. She had left. And it had been happening a couple of times. And there was like a particular group that were doing it. But for Luke to have the bravery to say that, I was like, okay, this guy and I are going to be friends. We're going to figure it out now. And I also, there was a posse of about five or six NSA pupils, and we were all like clinging together. And it felt like that moment where I was like, oh, I can let that go now. There's something new that's happening here.
There's others now. Yeah, there's other people. Your varsity friends are really your friends for life. I mean, you're lucky
it's the first group of people that you choose
to
be friends with.
Your high school guys, you're lucky if you can stay friends with them, but the varsity ones are really the ones that are quite deep.
I have more varsity or friends than I do high school friends.
Although Marin is a very vast circle of friends, and he attracts people to him, and he's just a wonderful person to be a friend.
I can get that sense here. But we've got the films that you love across your life, and the one in your varsity time is called the It's Getting Serious film. So we call them your loves, your four great loves. There's your puppy love, which is the first film you've ever loved. Your high school crush, which comes to you in high school and sort of challenges, you know, your attraction. But what we're talking about here is It's Getting Serious, which is that sort of much deeper. It's that point in your life where you really start crafting your character and your identity. And here you guys are going, fuck this shit. I'm here to learn. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to take this shit seriously. This isn't just... So what movies do you remember from those after years that
Well, I'm going to go back now because you're reminding me. So I guess my puppy love one, I mean, my dad, he worked for Gallo Record Company, and Gallo, I think, owned New Metro at the time in the early 90s. And what down was like a dungeon. And every Friday, if you were an employee, you can rent a movie for R2 for the weekend. So he would rent five. He'd take R10 and we'd watch one on a Friday, two on a Saturday, two on a Sunday. And then we'd watch the 8 o'clock movie, right? So I got pummeled with a lot of stuff I should absolutely not have watched at that age, but my dad didn't give a shit. So, but I would say like a significant moment for me was Jim Carrey. It was like Ace Ventura, the first one.
Okay, cool.
That was the puppy love one.
Yeah, high school crush.
Then the high school one, it got a little bit weird because everybody was really into Romeo and Juliet. And I was like,
Baz Luhrmann one.
Yeah, and I was like, guys, have you watched Seven?
Yeah.
So
exactly.
It went you see, because my dad was just like, let's go watch, you know, so Seven and Fight Club, which was probably later in my high school career, were like these two, and they're both like David Fincher, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So
wouldn't you say that, I don't know, coming out of high school, coming out of the puppy love thing, maybe you're going to get to it now, but like, Marin is a student of Friends, the TV show. And like, he knows every in and out of it. And that was informative in our career because we got... Like that's the first start into TV with sitcom.
We're talking about movies, but yes, the obsession of Friends and then the complete obsession with Frasier as well. Those two ones were just like, you know, and even now, like I rewatch them when I'm falling asleep.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that you want, the safety of falling asleep is something that you're not going to miss. And then I'm going to struggle to think about like what's the movie for you in varsity?
The varsity ones?
The varsity one for me, I would say is... there's a film called Carlito's Way by Brian De Palma.
Sure.
Mm. And
haven't seen it. Know of it.
Bro, you got to watch this film. It's unbelievable. I mean,
the big guys in that?
It's Al Pacino, Sean Penn. The female actress, I can't remember her name, but she didn't go on to do too much with her life.
I think Luis Guzman as
he's in it as well.
Luis Guzman. Yeah, I always think of everything. Community.
Me too.
Whenever I think of him. But Pacino, actor Luis Guzman, because he went to our school. Yeah.
Pacino had just won for Dog Day Afternoon.
That's a good
This film. Is the next film.
No, Luke. Dog Day Afternoon is from the 70s. Remember, he did Scarface.
This is in the 70s, bro.
It's set in the 70s.
Yeah, but it's
early 90s it was when it was made. No, I'm telling you, because everybody says it's almost like the run-up, the aftermath of Scarface.
Oh, you're right, 93. It was 93.
Yeah, it's like,
and
almost...
And it's set in 75.
It's like, okay, it's like if Scarface survived and went to prison. Like, people did that, but Brian De Palma was like, no, that's not what the fuck is happening.
Yeah.
It's based on two novels by a judge, a New York City circuit judge, who saw the same criminal coming into his court case like three or four different times. And he wrote a book about this guy, Carlito Brigante. Okay. And the film starts out with Carlito being
released,
getting off on a technicality, and his lawyer managed to get him off. Sean Penn is the lawyer, but he's a Jewish lawyer. Mm. It's an amazing transformation. And Carlito is determined to do right and to fix his life. And he doesn't want to go down the bad route anymore. He's being a gangster and a criminal, but all he wants to do is get $65,000 together, and he's going to go to
the
Mexico
with the palm trees.
He's going to rent cars and live his life in peace. And it's the story of a good man who keeps making the wrong decision for the right reasons. And that is a thematic that I've found kind of repeating in my
interesting.
So you say that, but the way that you put it to me, because Luke was actually the one who said, he had told me, you've got to watch Carlito's Way. So, and then the way I sort of interpreted it for myself, and I think we had a conversation about it, was a man who's he's turned over a new leaf and is struggling to keep that leaf turned over. Mm. And around every corner,
that's a nice
new things or
analogy, way of looking at it. Okay, cool.
An amazing chase scene in the last act. Okay. Fantastic gun gangster stuff. Really powerful movie. I love that film. And then Dumb and Dumber. Dumb and Dumber was my high school crush.
Really?
Cool.
I can still not watch that without rolling on the floor, literally in stitches. I just think it's the funniest thing. The original was the best. You know, the remakes they've done since then haven't been up to scratch.
So I've been, like, for me, like the whole of high school, I even bought like a little tiny biography. It was like about 70 pages on Jim Carrey. I was obsessed. So anything Jim Carrey related, I was consuming. And then Friends came along, and Chandler, I just obsessed with Chandler and Niles.
Mm.
And then
in Frasier,
and I think now when you look at it, I think that as an actor, I'm starting to realize that all of those things you'll see influences.
Yeah,
and I think specifically in Lucky Fish. I mean, Lucky Fish, I gave it my everything. You know, the other ones that I did, I was like, yeah, you know, sometimes you phone in a performance, or you know, you don't, or and other ones that you like really dig into. And this one, it was like, even though it's a comedy, I threw everything in the kitchen sink at it, man. Like everything, it was like, and rewatching Martin Short in
Pure Luck,
Inner Space,
what a classic.
Watching Jim Carrey again, watching like Ace Ventura, more Pet Detective than the first one.
Okay,
more When Nature Calls than the Pet Detective. And then there's some real moments of timing. And because I've had to edit the film, you're watching it over and over again. Okay,
you editing it as
no,
well?
No. You sit with the editor and you give notes or whatever, and you just over and over again, right? And then you start separating yourself from who's on the screen.
Yeah.
And like I would say to Brett, like the continuity is out because I kept improvising physically.
Yeah.
And I was like, this actor is fucking with my life. And Brett was like, no, Marine, you are fucking with my life. That's what this is, conversation that he and I had. And but when you look at it, you're like, oh shit, I can tell where the Martin Short moment is. I can tell where the Jim Carrey moment, I can see where the Chandler moment is.
That's lovely.
We had to, Marine kept pushing us to be like, guys, it's not slapstick. We got to make it more authentic. And I'm like, bro, we've made a comedy and it is freaking funny and there's some slapstick moments. I mean, there's one scene where, you know, everybody projectile vomits over everyone else. And it's like, there's only one way to do that. You know, you can't like hold back on that.
I was saying all the moments in between those big verbose things. I mean, but Josh wanted to go big. And I guess we did. It came up on one of our groups.
Yeah.
Josh and I was trying to steer it more toward the bridesmaid moment.
Okay.
With the vomiting and stuff. And Josh then was like, Stand By Me. And I was like, okay, let's watch that scene again. And we watched it a couple of times, the vomiting scene in Stand By Me.
I can't remember the vomiting scene.
The cherry pie. He's trying to eat the cherry pie.
It's not actually, it's like somebody's telling a story.
No, he's telling a story about
of this cherry pie eating contest, and then everybody vomits from the cherry pies. And so the story itself is larger than life.
Yeah.
So then we got, I think a little bit of both, the bridesmaids moment and the...
Cool.
You know.
But lovely, guys. Making the film has been interesting because, like, I think there's so much about our history of, like, the type of content we make, which we're trying to appeal to a large audience as possible. I mean, City Sizzler was a sitcom we made early in our career, and it was, you know, like a basic ripple for Friends, but six friends living in a loft, and, you know, one's white, one's Indian, one's Zulu. Yeah. But, like, we were talking about this the other day. I think that so much of what the broadcasters and the gatekeepers are, like, forcing content to be created now is siloed. And, well, this is a piece of content that only Zulu, of course, so people can enjoy. Mm. Or this is a piece of content that's just for the Afrikaans audience.
Yeah.
And we don't want to do that. We want to make content that the South Africans can enjoy. So, yes, there's an Indian audience at its core here, but it's family and it's friendly and it's fun and everybody can watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's characters who are Indian, but it's not an Indian film.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to...
Sure. No, that makes sense. And obviously, the cinema screenings being both the Diff Festival screenings, but also when we do a cinema release, obviously it's fun to be together and be in a group. But... where's its life after that? Have you got a streamer lined up?
Mm. We do, yeah. So it'll be on Prime in September, yeah.
And that's great because I really do think that the streaming has opened up so much more audience for South African filmmakers. You know, it is great that you're doing a cinema release. I think there's obviously still something so special about getting together in a group. And you can imagine, hopefully, some of these cinemas in the Durban area, like, just being packed with the people that are seeing themselves.
I hope.
That's the dream, right?
Do you remember?
So that you can be together.
And do you maybe remember?
Some of those tinned fish sandwiches can be served.
Mm-hmm.
But I do really think that streaming really has helped the South African
industry.
Wait a
minute, this is coming from
a
cinema distributor?
That's what I'm saying, okay. As an exhibitor, because just so many more eyeballs are on them.
Sure, from a marketing point of view, but let me put it to you this way. Do you remember that movie Cinema Paradiso?
Sure.
The way that they communicate the event or the experience of all being in a room together as a community and experiencing, and each beat of the movie, everybody is feeling the same thing.
No, it's so special. I mean,
yeah, and I think that like the Indian community, for example, you know, and it's not even just the Indian community. Like, we've had Zandri watch it. I've seen white people, my girlfriend's Jewish family, and it's the same response no matter who the fuck you are, no matter what color you are. I'm watching them watching the movie, and I'm like, it's exactly at that moment where this thing happens, where there's a laugh, where there's a...
There are three moments
where people potentially cry. There are three moments.
To your point about the streamers, yes, there is a larger audience there. But
down the line, just saying at some point.
Like, you're a little boat that's been put into the ocean.
Yeah.
The ocean of content.
Yeah, sure.
That will just crush you. Yes, it's available, for sure. But you know, once I've made that sale, there's no incentive for me to get that audience to watch it.
Yeah.
And there's no incentive for that streamer to do the same, other than for the flavor of the week for this 2 days.
But at
two
least
days
you
in a
at
week
least
when
you don't
drop.
Disappear is the question, is the argument, where at least you know, there was always the challenge in cinema that there can only be so much space, and the South African films, you know, in the mainstream cinemas would, you know, last a few weeks and would have to be bumped when the next Marvel came.
Well,
and the Bioscope was always the cinema that was like, you're our Spider-Man. Like, we're going to give you as much as we can. And that's still the case today. But I just love the fact that it doesn't then disappear entirely. Like, it can live on.
Sale really meant that we had an anchor tenant in our finance plan and we were able to build the rest of the finance around it, you know?
Yeah, that's cool.
So it was is essential. And as a businessman, the fact that we're doing a theatrical release now is great. It costs us money. We're spending money on this marketing, but it will be like, hopefully there'll be money to come from it, but it does not influence whether or not the film is profitable because we've already covered our costs with the sale to the streamer.
Yeah, it just, Luke and I just happened to make a brilliant film that everybody thought needs to go to the cinema.
Yeah.
No, this is definitely one of them. And I think, especially comedy, especially something with a nice, unique, potent flavor.
I also think it's like a little bit like Luke and I survived this wave, I think, I don't know when was it, from 2015 until like 2023, where it was like comedy was unsellable. It was like us, Burnt Onion, and maybe one other or
Black
two.
Black Brain made
but and the Afrikaans dudes who did Hotel, or right? Like
Nachtvlug and
right? But we survived that thing. And for me, this is just like a way to prove to the gatekeepers, again, comedy fucking works. Sure. Stop saying things. You're siloing everything, just like Luke said, in terms of the Zulu Xhosa market or whatever, but you're also saying that about comedy. You're saying only these people find that funny. Only these people find this funny. And that's why we're scared of...
But funny also changes. Funny evolves.
Yeah.
What we... Like, you go look at an old Steve Martin stand-up special from, you know, a couple of decades ago. Like, sure. In many ways, it's like it's just not funny anymore.
But then you watch Dumb and Dumber, and you still roll on the floor laughing. You see what I'm saying?
That's no, of course. There is
no, but the kids jokes. These days are finding other things funny,
but just
for sure.
Humor does evolve. And as long as you've always... kept it as fresh or as evolved in terms of its comedy as possible.
Yeah, and I think that's what we've done. Like,
that's lovely.
You can see our comedy, the writing of the comedy is so vastly different to what City Sessler was. From that into Elke Skiverpot, into Die Kasteel, into Black Tax, into this, you can see things have gotten quicker. Dropping laugh tracks, trying to find the comic timing in a smart way. The evolution of an A, B, and C storyline is no longer available to me. Everything's born out of an A storyline. Okay. I'm not separating storylines anymore. It's born out of it. And then that's why it all interacts with one another at the end.
Yeah.
Whereas A, B, and C storylines used to resolve independently of one another.
Be very insular, yeah.
Now they're all the problem for one storyline is the solution for another. That's how it evolves, you know?
Yeah.
And you've got to learn all of the shit, or you've got to observe constantly and go, what the fuck? How did Seinfeld get it right in the early 90s?
Yeah.
You know?
Shit. Lovely, guys. Congrats.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you.
Like, well done. This is a moment. This week is a nice chance to take some bows, both literally and figuratively. So I hope that these screenings go down well. Of course, it's the perfect festival to be the opening film for. Mm-hmm. And I just wish that this is a good week for you guys.
I'm excited for you to watch it, actually.
Thank you. I'm very keen. And of course, there's this needle drop where my band is going to be in a movie, which is exciting.
In one of the most seminal moments in the halfway through the film for the sardine run, for those who don't know, happens once a year when, you know, the sardines come along the warm currents of Durban's coastline and some of them beach themselves, and you've got the community rushing out there with their saris and their buckets, all picking up sardines, as many as possible. And we set a scene there. That was a big challenge. Like, how do we make this?
How do you recreate this?
100 extras on the beach and closing off the beach and having, you know, the night before discovering we didn't have the permits to have the vehicles on the beach. That was a real, that was a lot of fun.
But in a weird way, happy accident, it worked to our advantage.
Absolutely.
How so?
Well,
you were able to populate, I felt like you were able to populate the beach now in a way that I felt was more, because we were trying to do tricks.
Okay.
The reason we wanted those vehicles was so that we could close off the depth. So when you're putting extras, you can only put this many extras and there are no extras all the way down. So if we put a car in front, you know, between, you wouldn't have to see it. It actually worked better that it didn't go that way, because when you shot from the other side, there were all these like crane shots and stuff. Anyway, it worked to our advantage.
Okay, I can't wait.
And then you have the beautiful short straw bikini weather song playing over that little scene.
Bikini weather.
Yeah. Thank you, Russell.
Thank you, Russell.
No, listen, and we appreciate it. And we appreciate the fact that there was some budget for it. It's lovely, nice income for a band. But it also is just cool to be a part of it. And when it's the right song for the right moment, then it's magic.
Bikini weather on the beach. That's the perfect moment. Perfect song.
Lovely. But listen, thank you guys. Thank you for making some time to pop in and return your video, so I don't have to charge you.
Give us the late fees. Okay.
The late fees. No, but honestly, thanks for everything. Good luck. I hope it's a good week. And yeah, tickets are already on sale.
Yep.
And we look forward to screening it here at the Bioscope. So well done, guys.
Thank you, Russell.
Thank you, man.
We'll see you soon.
Okay. Cool. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. What a great chat. Another thing which I should have brought up with Luke, which I was very appreciative of was just as we opened up in our new location here at 44 Stanley, this was just as the lockdown levels were allowing us to host screenings. Of course, they had to be 50% capacity. Luke hired the Bioscope quite early on for a wrap party. And when he told me the numbers, which would mean a full house, I was a little anxious because the Bioscope couldn't have, you know, this kind of 100% capacity. But he had informed me that they were bubbling together as a result of that. They could all be in the same room. And of course, it was just so exciting to be in our new location and have this screening with a full house. So Luke can hold the title of having the first full house in our 44 Stanley venue way back in 2020. So lovely dude, lovely guy to catch up with. Very proud of them and happy for them with their film. And as we said, it's going to be screening in cinemas, including the Bioscope, real soon. So the links will be in the description. And we hope you guys go out and give it some love. All right. Thank you for listening. All the other filmmakers and interesting guests we've ever had, some of which are listed in our website. Otherwise, you can always just scroll back and see the other guest episodes. But that is over at thevideostore.co.za. All right. We'll see you guys again soon. Cheers.